Hello and welcome to the Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com.
And I'm Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net.
Hannah, a slower weekend at the box office than it has been in the past month or so. I think the only wide release is The Call of the Wild, which I didn't see because I want to take my son to it this weekend.
And I didn't see it, but I heard you better be prepared taking a young child because I heard that there's some pretty dark stuff in there. So,
well, good. It's time for him to be exposed that the world is not all gummy bears and Smurfs.
Does the world really need another Charlie? I'm not sure. And the other one we're missing or skipped or opened cold, I'm not even sure. Brahms, The Boy 2?
Nobody's seen that yet. They paid for it because the studio wouldn't let anybody see it.
Exactly. But you did see a big one from last week that you've caught up on with your kid. So what's the verdict on Sonic the Hedgehog?
We did go see Sonic, and well, he had no idea who Sonic the Hedgehog was because that's before his time. And I only vaguely know who Sonic was because I didn't grow up with a Sega Genesis. We were a Nintendo family. I knew he was blue. I knew he ran fast. But I appreciated Jim Carrey. Jim Carrey is the only reason for any adult to sit through this. I know some people are running in the street saying this is the best movie made from a video game ever. I don't know. It's better than Super Mario Brothers, of course. I'm better than Doom, but it's still not great. And Jason Marsden, you know, he plays the straight man to this 10-year-old hedgehog, who's really annoying, in fact. But I did appreciate watching Jim Carrey go as nuts as he did, if you remember him way back on The Mask, mm-hmm. and how nuts he went. He gets to do it again, and I'm glad they gave him that chance, so it's not terrible.
More importantly, though, what did the child think?
He enjoyed it.
Okay,
he did like it.
So that's the important part of that.
Like, I can tell when he really loves something, and he didn't love it, but he liked it better than, I don't know, Star Wars, because he understood it.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. So moving on.
This episode, I think we're really going to, well, to plug what we're going to do. It's indie week for us. We watched 3 indie films. They're art house movies, you would say. And we're going to get through those. And then we've actually got top 5 lists. We don't usually do this. We usually save it for the end, you know, top 10, top 5 movies of the year. But we got, you got a hold of this list. It's somebody, I don't remember
Hollywood
who,
Reporter.
Put together, this is our 77 films we're looking forward to this year. And so we had the idea of going through and picking our top 5 films that we are looking forward to this year that were actually on this list of 77.
From that list. It was the 77 most anticipated films for the remaining of 2020. So that's what we're drawing from.
And I did it. I came up with 4, and I squeezed a 5th one in there, and because I was close to running to the bathroom to vomit after all of the remakes and sequels I saw that are on the way.
It is a lot of sequels, lot of remakes, and a few interesting sounding original ones in there. But we'll get to that in a bit.
All right. First, I want to talk about time, and I want to talk about place. There are movies out there that can be set anywhere. It doesn't matter where, but the 2 that we're going to bat lead off with have to be set where they are. They have to be set in Pyeongchang, South Korea. They have to be there, and the other one has to be in Leningrad, Russia. And time. Sometimes a movie can be set in 2020, 2010, 1970. It does not matter, but the 2 movies we're going to talk about have to be set in 2018 and have to be set in 1945. They're just these huge nailing characteristics. It has to be here and it has to be at this particular time because we're talking about post-war Soviet Union when there are no more men left. They all died. And because Leningrad went through one of the famous sieges in all of history, the famine, the pestilence, the just inhumanity. And then we're going to talk about the Olympics, the Olympic Games.
And then I've got a 3rd one to throw in there. So we'll get to that.
Since I did not see Ordinary Love, tell me, or if you can squeeze it into the box, how it has to be said in that time, and it has to be said in that place.
It doesn't. So that's what the beauty of it is, that it's an everyday movie. It's a it's a relevant, emotional, observational drama that is not so much about the specific time and place as about one couple's response to illness. And so the wife is diagnosed with breast cancer, and so it's about a year in the life of this loving, long married couple, and how that diagnosis really disrupts their lives and their routine. And I mean, it is a masterclass in acting. It's Leslie Manville. So you told me you never saw Phantom Thread, but she's actually one of the best parts of that fashion drama. And she was nominated for a Best Supporting Actress for her role in that film. But here she plays the wife, and Liam Neeson plays the husband. And for finally, this movie is set in Belfast. And so we actually get to hear Liam Neeson talk like Liam Neeson. He is just a regular guy from Ireland, and he gets to talk the way he would normally talk. This is not one of these big Liam Neeson action-adventure movies. The only special skills that he really needs to employ are being compassionate, supportive, loving, and dealing with the scary day in, day out stuff of living with a cancer diagnosis in your house. And it really just goes from one Christmas to the next. And it's about the quiet moments. It's about the little moments. And it's just so relatable and powerful in its quietness and poignancy. I think you'd actually really like it. It's difficult material. It's a difficult subject to tackle, but it's not one of these like insanely oppressive watches. It's going to be relatable to so many people, but yeah, it's a tough sell. But all I can say is that the two actors really make it work. And it was written by this playwright, Owen McCafferty, and it really was based on his own experiences in having been telling somebody about his wife's diagnosis with breast cancer and what they went through. And that's why I think this is just a very pleasant and important kind of film that whether or not people will go and see it, it's a tough call. But for these two actors' performances, very stripped down, moving performances, I think it might be worth checking out at the Art House Theater, or you find it later when it's streaming.
But Hannah, listening to you describe the plot, I have seen Liam Neeson in a film where his wife died of cancer and he was supportive and compassionate, and it was called Love Actually.
This is so different. This is not Love Actually. This is two people. It is not five different storylines being interwoven into a Christmas movie, although this does take place from Christmas to Christmas. But while there are elements, I suppose you could say, parallel that classic character, this is not going to be a Love Actually. It's not going to reach that level of stature in people.
Is this ordinary love? Is this a weeper? Will people be mopped out of the theater amongst a sea of tears?
No, and I think that's why it's worth seeing, is it's not one of these incredibly heavy melodramatic things. It's more like you get misty-eyed because you kind of relate. You know, anybody who's ever watched anyone who's gone through illness, gone through that, just the operations and the chemo and the losing their hair and the anxiety over what the next scan might show and just trying to not really knowing how you're supposed to act and can you still joke around. So it's life affirming in the end. It's kind of uplifting in its messaging. And so it's not one of those ones that you'll need a box of tissues. You'll just need that one tissue to just kind of get you through those little moments that just will just hit you.
Do they somehow incorporate Sade's Ordinary Love?
You are so off base on what this film is going for.
Well, I'm just saying.
No, I don't. Great song. I don't think they did. But you know what? I honestly, I'm not really quite sure. But it is based in shot in Belfast. And it's meant to be one of these quiet films where the silences are so potent and the glances. And this is where you need your veteran actors to pull off the things where just those looks and the glances and the pain in their eyes, the anguish is so palpable. You don't get that with with, I think, with actors who are maybe just starting out or who don't have those life experiences behind them. And so, again, it's just ordinary love. It's just a story of ordinary love in sickness and in health. And so,
thank you know. You so much for the transition. Speaking of silences and glances and pain through the eyeballs.
And anguish.
Let us talk about...
Major anguish.
Let us talk about Beanpole. Beanpole being Russia's entry into the most recent Academy Awards Best International Film. Okay, here we go. Beanpole is actually, at first, a very stereotypical Russian film, being that, good grief, it is tragic, weighty, and hard to watch frequently at points. In fact, I think the first 15 to 20 minutes of Beanpole are some of the roughest minutes in film from the entire last year. I did not know until I looked up the director. Kantemir Balagov. He was born in 1991.
Yeah, he's only 28
like,
now.
So when he filmed this, he was like 27 years
yeah,
old.
Yeah, 26,
this 27,
I think.
26-year-old filmed this gargantuan drama of, as you put it, anguish. Leningrad in 1945 is not a place you wanted to hang out. You didn't want to go there for the weekend. It's immediately after World War II, and everything is a shambles. We meet Ia, wonderfully played by Victoria Miroshnichenko.
Yeah, I'm leaving the names to you, dude.
And it's her first feature, by the way.
It is.
The director says he did not cast her because she was tall, but because she was right for the role. But thankfully, she was tall, even though, you know, the movie's called Beanpole. I learned that in Russian, it doesn't really translate to being tall. It translates to clumsiness. But to English,
well,
you know,
yeah,
we got to be
tall. She's lanky.
She's very tall.
Tall and lanky and a little lumber-esque in her.
Ia has some extreme PTSD from the war. Extreme. She zones. Everybody knows it. She zones out. She makes these clicking noises, and she's just gone for a couple minutes. And then she'll come back, and she'll be fine. But she's a quiet lady. This is a female point of view. We're talking after, usually when you see films after a war, the soldiers are coming back from the front, from the war, and that's usually a male story. But this is a female point of view. The female soldier comes back, Masha, to join Ia, and they live in the same tiny room together and work in the same hospital. And there is a tragedy that happens. I'm not nowhere near going to give it away. Masha feels she is owed something from Ia, and Ia understands, yeah, I see your point. Maybe I can, you know, I like you, Masha. Maybe I even love you. I don't know. Feelings are hard to put into words, and I love words in this film. But she says, fine, I'm going to help you out here. It's 2 hours and 15 minutes of that, but far more morose than I put it. This was a Cannes film from last year, but not in the main competition. It was in the Un Certain Regard section, which is always, it's 20 films not in the competition that are featured because of their unusual styles and non-traditional stories. This won the best director of that particular section. And I love this section because, you know what it lost to this year was the Invisible Life from Brazil with the sisters.
Which
the year
I
before,
liked.
It was Border. Remember the trolls from like Scandinavia?
Oh, yeah. That
Isn't
was
it great?
Weird. That was a weird one.
So it's a wonderful, it's a wonderful section of Cannes. And I always am eager to catch up on a couple that filter out throughout the year. And this is, and Beanpole is one of them. Now, we kept up a little banter about Beanpole throughout the week, and you were I don't think you hated it, but man, I believe it made you depressed.
Yeah, it's a Charlie movie. It is sad and distressing and full of anguish.
It's very Russian.
And I'm like, and Russian. So, you know, I was like, yeah, yay you. I can do without this movie. Fortunately, in terms of writing for Chick Flicks, Artie Chick reviewed it, so all I had to do was kind of just weigh in, and even Artie Chick was very specific in saying this is not going to reach mainstream audiences.
What?
They're not going to necessarily even want it to reach them. They're not going to seek it out. This is an art house film. It is for those who, I mean, yes, granted, maybe if you I do remember Border being very interesting, and I did like Invisible Life better than this one. But I would say that those can be benchmarks, that if those are the kinds of films that you do go and seek out, then sure.
That's a good way to put that.
Throw Beanpole into the mix. But yeah, I mean, there are moments that are just ridiculously hard to watch. And I'm like, am I seeing what I think I'm seeing? And are there no repercussions for this? I don't understand.
I'm not saying that Leningrad in 45 was an anything goes environment, but I think things were a bit more permissible.
I guess so. But, it's just full of blackmail and grief and shame. And there's this doctor who I originally was like, okay, I'm liking this guy. And I'm not quite sure.
He's a good guy. How did you not like him in the end?
No, I did. I did like him, but I felt that, yes, he became sort of a pawn in what was happening between these two women. But he reminded me of, these two women are both brand new to acting, mm-hmm. Both of them. It's their first feature roles. Whereas this guy looked like he's probably been around a while, a little more veteran. He reminded me of like a Russian Daniel Day-Lewis. I kept thinking, who is this guy reminding me of?
Good Lord.
And that's what it felt like. So I liked his character. This is just one of those films that I can do without.
He's a tragic figure amongst an entire film of tragic figures. It's dripping in tragedy. I don't remember laughing. Like, I don't even think there was like a wry chuckle. It is a really hard watch, but frequently hard watches are worth it in the end. The credits are rolling, you're like, all right, that was tough. Oh my good Lord, that was tough, but I'm glad I did it.
Yeah, I can't say that. But hey, good on you.
All right, well, the film I've been comparing this to, because a particular location and a particular time, is Olympic Dreams. Olympic Dreams is from director Jeremy Teicher, and he co-wrote the script with the film's two stars, Alexei Pappas and Nick Kroll. Many in the audience may know Nick Kroll from his... You see him as a character actor in many movies, but I know him from the Netflix animated series Big Mouth. A lot of people know him from The League. He played an infamous character named Ruxin. And this is lost in translation at the Olympics. The reason this is getting the sort of buzz it's getting is because where it was shot and when it was shot in the Olympic Village during the Winter Olympics. The director won this prize. He's like, here, come here during the Olympics with all the athletes who are actually starring in his film and make your movie while we're doing the biathlon.
Yeah. very much guerrilla filmmaking at its core, like catch as catch can with running around the athletes' village and capturing some of these people and telling your story. So it has a very documentary vibe to it. And it's worth noting that the co-star to Nick Kroll, Alexei Pappas, is also a filmmaker. She's the wife of Jeremy Teicher and is a former Olympian herself. She's a runner from the, I believe, 2016 Olympics. And so it's not like they had no idea what they were walking into, so to speak. I think that the central character in this particular film is the setting, is getting that peek behind the curtain of what's going on in the athletes' village during the Olympic Games.
The characters we're talking about, Penelope and Ezra. She's an athlete. She comes over to do her cross-country skiing. He's a volunteer dentist. I didn't know the Olympics had volunteer dentists, but here he is over from America. And these two are lost. She expects to step off the plane and become an Olympian, join this elite camaraderie and have the time of her life. But she steps off the plane. She realizes, wow, I'm still the same person. Everything is awkward here. And my Olympics are suddenly over because my event is the first day. Ezra thinks he's going to come over and just figure out his life. He's going to figure out why his fiance wants to take a break. He's going to figure out why he's professionally in a rut. It's two lost characters, lost in translation, and they meet and they become lost together. I enjoyed it. I liked it. I'm glad they didn't do certain things to him. I'm not going to give any away, but I'm glad Penelope and Ezra did what they did. Did you pick up the feeling, as I did, this was a very imposing setting and backdrop, screaming for a stronger story?
Absolutely. In fact, I felt that there was obviously so much ad-libbing that they had to do. I felt like they had an outline, like they went into this with a general story, a sense of what the story might be, and then went, okay, look, you guys, you go out there. We're going to go shoot this cool scene now right over by the mountain, by the sleds and the bobsled people. and say something poignant or funny or emotional. And then hopefully by the time we get to our climax, we will have, the story will have caught up to where we hope to end this film before the credits roll. And so I do feel that for a film that is, I think, trying to say it's a romantic drama, sports drama, and I know you sort of watched it, I think, from a slightly different perspective. I felt that there was a real issue with a lack of chemistry between these two leads. You kind of mentioned that you felt that that was sort of part of the point. To me, that lack of chemistry was diminished the story, which already was kind of lacking.
The story is absolutely thin. It is very thin. It would have been served better if it didn't actually take place at the Olympics. Because, I mean, they're in the Olympic Stadium. Those are the figure skaters. The people in his dental chair are the athletes. And it didn't, I'm not saying I need machine guns and hostages. I don't. I'm glad, I love Lost in Translation, and I'm fine with storylines like that. I understand people could get lost and find each other to help get through life. But the setting does not match the characters, does not match the plot. However, I still give this a positive review. I enjoyed watching this film. I like both of the characters. I found they did have chemistry. They were just too separate people in different parts of their lives for it to work.
Yeah, I mean, they were likable individually. Both these actors,
and she did very well. She was great. Acting-wise, Alexi Pappas, I think, was great.
Well, I think both of them sort of brought their individual style to these roles. They're very approachable. It is kind of nice to see what generally look like average-looking people as the leads in a film.
No, it's not Scarlett Johansson, no.
But the irony is that Penelope was more fun to watch when she was flirting with Gus Kenworthy, an openly gay skier who was playing himself in this film. And so she was more fun and approachable and likable and flirty. And I felt there was more chemistry between them than there was when she was sort of attempting to flirt with the dentist. And so that to me was, it just made for a very uneven film. And so while I still kind of liked it too, but I liked it really more just because you say it would have been better in a different setting, but I'm not sure, that the setting is really the only reason for this particular story. So it would be really difficult to try and transplant that somewhere else. But I do think they were trying so hard to sort of look cool that the story got lost.
You know, I just realized we've seen thousands and thousands of films. And I think we've seen every profession under the sun that you can name. But this is the first time I've ever seen volunteer dentist at the Olympics.
Absolutely. But you know what? When it comes to a romance, sports drama type of movie with an Olympic theme, I am the cutting edge all the way.
I love the cutting edge.
I love the cutting edge. All I kept thinking was, I haven't seen the cutting edge in a long time.
It's a great movie.
And that's one of those films that I can stop a million times if I come across it on TV. Olympic Dreams is not that. So
they do not do the Pamchenko twist.
They don't do the Pamchenko twist. And I won't even remember what she competed in necessarily in 6 months. But so that really was the overarching thing for me was like, I'm like, oh, you know, I missed the cutting edge. So for nothing else, I do think Olympic Dreams would be a lot of fun for any folks that might actually have these Olympic dreams or think about volunteering in like a medical profession.
Once again, we have your hyper-local focused film recommendations. This is for you.
It is.
If you've ever been a volunteer dentist at the Olympics.
Or if you just have, if you've got a teenager who dreams of being part of the Athletes Village, or actually you have...
It's a good warning. You'll be the same person you are today.
It is. I actually think it really could serve as great exposure to anyone who is stepping into that world. And so it will give them a very authentic look at what it looks like behind the curtain there, where most of the time, you know, only athletes and a very select few are able to go. So for that, Olympic Dreams gets bonus points.
All right, well, moving on from looking back at 1945 and all the way back to 2018, let's look ahead. Let's look ahead to the rest of 2020, of which there's pretty much 80% left of the year. And we're going to talk about our top fives, at least from the select list of 77, because I guarantee you 2020's beanpole is not on this list, which I will enjoy much more than Hannah's picks, I assure you. So, Hannah, what is your number five pick that you're looking forward to this year?
I think my number five pick will be the one that's coming out the soonest, which and is getting a lot of buzz right now, which is Ben Affleck in The Way Back. And so, you know, him playing this alcoholic widower, high school
talk about a sports
basketball
drama.
Coach, another sports drama. So, you know, there's our segue from one sports drama to another. And so The Way Back just looks, at least it's an original one. So I'm putting something on the list that's not a remake or a sequel. So for that, I just think it'll be really interesting to see how Ben Affleck holds it together for a role that apparently has some pretty significant parallels to his existence.
Yeah, he's been in the news recently, and I think it's because of the subject matter of this film. I have not seen your list. Listeners, I have not seen her list, and I guarantee you it's going to be full of remakes and sequels, and I'm shocked that this was not one, so good on you for picking an original film.
And it comes out March 6th, by the way.
That's pretty quick. Mm-hmm. My number five comes out in early July. It's Free Guy, starring Ryan Reynolds. He is a non-playable character in a video game who gains self-awareness. It's got this Wreck-It Ralph vibe in it. I can feel maybe a little Ready Player One, film I adored. And, you know, while I was looking through this list of, good Lord, you know, there's an X-Men movie, there's two Marvel films, there's another Fast and Furious, there's another Minions, and a Ghostbusters remake. Oh, look, this is original. This is original. And the last time I saw Ryan Reynolds do something original was, you know, Deadpool. And that was awesome. That was wonderful. So I hope he strikes gold again with Free Guy.
Yeah, I love Ryan Reynolds. So I'm all for any Ryan Reynolds movie. So that's like an automatic for me. I look forward to every Ryan Reynolds movie. So rather than try and spell that out every year, just know that if Ryan Reynolds is in it, I will likely go see it. And so it will therefore be anticipated. I am actually looking at my list and making some changes as we go along.
Shame on you.
I know. But I think I am going to go with my next one to be a sort of tie. It's Black Widow, because I know you hate that, but it's the two superheroine movies that are coming out. We have Black Widow with Scarlett Johansson and Wonder Woman 1984 with Gal Gadot. So those two, I'm looking forward for that girl power, superpower films. And so one, you know, Black Widow is, I would guess, an origin story. And Wonder Woman 1984, a sequel of sorts to the Wonder Woman that we got a few years ago, which did very well. So I'm looking forward to both of those.
I knew Wonder Woman was going to be on your list. I didn't think Black Widow would make it. It's, oh, I know she's going to. She loved Wonder Woman, and this one's going to be on there. And it's got Chris Pine. I think she likes Chris Pine.
I do like Chris Pine. Although he's supposed to be dead, so you know I don't get that. But go ahead.
My number four does not have a release date, but it's coming out in 2020. It's from Spike Lee. And it's Da Five Bloods. At Middleburg, Terrence Blanchard, the composer, sneak peeked this. He says Spike Lee, you know, he's doing the music for Spike Lee's next movie, and he says it's going to take place in Vietnam. And I love Spike Lee movies. This is going to star Chadwick Boseman. Give me anything and everything Spike Lee, hence it's my number four.
And give me anything Chadwick Boseman. You know, I'm
Black Panther himself.
Black Panther. So, you know, I think that's good for following Black Widow, Wonder Woman, and then we get Black Panther in your pick. So so that's that'll be interesting. But yes, we're definitely anticipating very different types of films as we look ahead.
But it's not a surprise. Like, you're not shocked at my list, and I'm definitely not shocked at your
list. And again,
and
these are movies that I'm just most excited personally to see. So it might not be so much about reading the encapsulations of what these films are about as just saying, oh, you know, this is one that I remember just sort of hearing the early buzz about, or I'm just psyched to see it just for the fun cinematic experience.
I haven't seen your list, but I know it's number one.
I know you do.
I already know.
It's not, it would not be, you do not have to be a psychic to look ahead at what my number one would be. However, my before we get to one, I think we're at three. And for that, I have an animated movie. And this was tough because I'm looking ahead at all these different animated films coming out, a lot of sequels. But the one that looked most intriguing to me is called Soul. And it is Jamie Foxx. as this jaded musician who's somehow transported out of his body and has to find his way back. And it's from the director of Up and Inside Out. And it comes out in June 19th. And so that just, to me, has tremendous promise.
Yeah, it's hard to go wrong. Is it Pixar?
Probably, if it was Up and Inside Out. Because
Inside Out was such a great movie that it's got a pedigree behind it.
Yeah, so I'm looking forward to that.
My number three is a remake. I didn't think I'd put a remake on it, but I did, and it's coming out way later in December. It's from Denis Villeneuve, and it's the remake of Dune. Dune, the original one, if you saw it, it became a cult classic because many people thought it was so bad it was good. And it's, you know, it's still got midnight screenings because it's so bad it's good. It's got Sting in it and a young Kyle MacLachlan. But other people say it's a great film and they'll defend it until the day they die. But this is a director who made Arrival and Blade Runner 2049. 2049 was my favorite film that year. This guy's got vision. He's got atmosphere and tone, and it's got your boy Timothy Chalamet.
I do love my Timothy Chalamet.
So sign me up for the remake of Dune.
I was not a, you know, that's just not my cup of tea so much. But yeah, it's I'm glad for you that it will definitely be one for your list. My next one is it's a tie, but it's more of a thematic tie, and that is that I love movie musicals and stage musicals. And so this year we have coming out in June, In the Heights, Lin-Manuel Miranda. Everybody's psyched for that one, except for you. and then October 23rd, we have Everybody's Talking About Jamie, which nobody probably is talking about yet because very few people in the U.S. have seen it. But I saw Everybody's Talking About Jamie on stage in London, and it's a very hugely popular London musical right now about this British teen who wants to be a drag queen. And it's so I think that's going to sneak in and really surprise people because it's a very entertaining and moving film, or at least it's a moving show. And so if that translates properly onto film, I think people will be talking about Jamie. And then December, end of the year, West Side Story, which considering I'm going to see West Side Story this weekend on Broadway, that was top of mind, and it will be interesting to compare.
You mean I have to sit through three musicals this year?
Yes. Jeez. There were more. There were more than this, but these were the three key ones. And so it will be very interesting because the movie adaptation versus what's coming out as a very different adaptation on stage on Broadway right now, it will be very interesting to compare and contrast both of those adaptations to the original, which is, you know, just a classic.
Well, our number twos could not be more different. you went musical. Oh, I love the songs. Love da-da-da-da. I can't wait for, again, July, the new Christopher Nolan called Tenet. It's very hush-hush, but all I know, it's Christopher Nolan and time travel. And the man who did Inception and the man who did Dunkirk can time travel me any day, especially with John David Washington, speaking of Spike Lee, who's Black Klansman, and Robert Pattinson. So I'm ready to be wowed. Christopher Nolan.
Christopher Nolan, yes. I'm sure that if I'm not wowed, my brain will at least be blown. That's the only thing that
I'm already seeing when the credits rolling. I'm gonna try to mansplain it. I'm like, all right, I know you probably didn't understand this, so
that's right. I'll be like, my head hurts, and is the die ever gonna stop rolling? So yeah, that'll be interesting. And yes, my number one is so easy for you to pick out.
I'm gonna
Charlie.
Guess you feel the need for speed.
I do feel the need for speed when I talk about my most anticipated. It's because this one has that nostalgia factor for me, and it is Top Gun Maverick, Maverick. And Tom Cruise will be back as Maverick in an all-new story that I'm sure will look a lot like the old story. But yeah, it's a sequel to the 1986 classic, and it just it's just one of those ones that has incredible meaning to me because in college there was a group of us that became somewhat obsessed with Top Gun, and we hope to all actually reunite for Maverick. And so just the opportunity for all these years later for that same group of us to get back together to once again go and watch Tom Cruise as Maverick. That alone makes it my most anticipated film of 2020.
The reason it's not on my top five is because I'm so worried they will ruin that love and feeling.
Don't lose that love and feeling. They're going to ruin that. Please.
He's already lost it.
I can guarantee they're already trying to figure out how to recreate the volleyball scene in a new way on the beach. So that'll be, as long as that's in there, I think we'll be
all right.
As
long as my tagline doesn't end up being Slider, it stinks.
See, but there's so much. That's just it. How many films can you remember, you know, 30 years later where you just absolutely still can quote, son, your body's writing checks, your ego can't cash. I mean, these are classics. So, you know, hey, yeah, it'll be fun. So what's your number one that I'm sure I won't.
Once again, July. About? July is the month of the year. Remember, we talked about Free Guy, which is July. We talked about Tenet, which is July. And also in July, from Mr. Wes Anderson, The French Dispatch. He's bringing back his crew. Bill Murray, Tilda Swinton, Frances McDormand, Adrian Brody, Owen Wilson, Edward Norton, Willem Dafoe, Angelica Houston, the crew, and your boy, Timothy Chalamet, is coming in The French Dispatch. I love Wes Anderson. Oh my God, I can't wait.
I mean, Wes Anderson is an acquired taste. And so for those who love Wes Anderson, this is probably, without a doubt, all of their, for everyone who's a Wes Anderson fan, I am sure that that is the most anticipated film of 2020 for them as well. And so I'm on the fence with Wes Anderson. It's like, I like his stuff, but I am not as deeply obsessed with it as many of his followers are. And so it did not crack my top five or possibly even my top 10, but I can totally see how
it would
excite
you. You gave us a top 10. You had so many ties. Well, I'm just, you know, it's another original one after all these sequels and remakes. We have to sit through another Ghostbusters this year. How many Ghostbusters do I have to sit through?
Well, and I thought about it. I'm like, I'm not excited about the new Ghostbusters movie. I'm not terribly excited about the next Bond film.
Fast and the Furious 9.
You know, Fast Bond and the 25? Furious 9. Come on. I know. So while I do hope, I mean, Legally Blonde 3.
Oh, man. Bend and snap my hip.
So while I certainly hope that they don't destroy the legacy of their predecessors, and I hope that I like those films. Yes, when it came to picking really my most anticipated, I tried to find those ones that were slightly outside of the norm in terms of the ones that we've already seen a million times, and hope that, you know, just hope that they make us proud and make us enjoy our time in the theater. But out of that 77, though, reading through, I was like, you know, we've got an interesting 9 months or 10 months ahead.
That list doesn't even include what will be the next 19 bean poles.
Exactly. It does not include any of the Charlie indie small,
all the good stuff,
crazy good stuff, distressing films that we have to look forward to in the months ahead.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks.
All right, quick recap. Ordinary Love.
You know, it's sweet and relatable. So, but I think you can wait. But if you do happen to catch it, or you see that it's playing in an art house theater near you, think about it. It might be worth checking out.
Beanpole is not sweet and relatable, and it actually should come with a free t-shirt that says, when you walk out of the theater, I survived Beanpole.
See, I thought it would be a t-shirt that just said, kill me now.
Oh, and Olympic Dreams, light as a feather.
Yeah, it is what it is, and as
for all you volunteer Olympic dentists.
Exactly. And my brother's name is Ezra, so I can appreciate any film where the lead character's name is a dorky guy named Ezra. See, he won't be listening to this podcast, so I can say that because this will be my proof that he didn't actually listen.
Ezra, if you hear this, well, yeah, you probably won't.
That's right.
All right, well, thank you very much for listening to this episode of The Cinema Clash. I am Charlie Jewell.
I'm Hannah Buchdahl.
Bye.
Take care.